This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Julian Ng.
Good morning.
Julian, how was your three-day weekend?
Oh, I enjoyed it. It was lovely. And I was on leave on Friday as well, so it was a four-day weekend for me.
Oh, so you're just so greedy. You just can't have enough. You have to have more than everybody else.
Delicious.
Delicious. Okay, we're actually, it's a short week for us. And of course, this coming weekend's also another three-day weekend.
Really?
Yeah, of course. The 1st of May is Labor Day. It's an international holiday. It's a holiday that celebrates the
working
man and woman.
Very important holiday, actually.
Yeah, very important for all kinds of historic reasons, right? And it's a reminder that the backbone of any economy and society is the men and women who work.
Absolutely.
So I think it also celebrates the advent of the eight-day work day, something that workers in the...
Eight-hour work day.
The men and women in the trade union movement and the radical workers' movements of the 19th century, struggled for. So
I think we've violated that in many ways because we work like 17, 18 hours now, don't we?
some of us have four-day weekends. But yes, absolutely. I mean, I think the casualization of work, the flexible work hours, all these, which are supposed to be signaled in some form of liberation for workers, has maybe turned against the worker itself. And so a lot of the flexibility has also come with insecurity, and so that's another dimension, especially in the 21st century, for the realities of work for the ordinary man and woman.
You know, Sharad, I've started rewatching the Downton Abbey TV series again, and it always tickles me when the family, Grantham family, meets up with somebody who works. You know, gone are the days when there were these classes, the working class and the upper classes of society, which look down and frown upon people who actually have day jobs. It's just very funny, but it's really tells a story and very typical of a time from the past when there were these such classes.
Yeah, I remember when the Dowager, one of the major characters. She's the mother of Mr. Grantham.
Most favorite characters in the show.
Actually. Yeah, and so she says something like, "Somebody, they're having a discussion. Somebody mentions a weekend. And she's weekend. What's a weekend? Yeah. Well,
that's the only thing that we look forward to these days.
So, International Workers' Day, May Day, Labor Day, all again. Celebrating the work and the centrality of the working class for the modern world. So that's today. Sorry, that's next Monday. Yesterday, of course, our day off was because we had the installation of the Agong, and of course that's reflected in almost all the morning papers, bar one. So Sina Harian has a story about Tun Mahathir and the Bank Negara forex losses. Probe. So that's the one newspaper that's kind of broke away from the pack. Every other newspaper looks at the installation that happened yesterday. And of course, if you were keeping track of that event yesterday, you would have had your fill. So the newspapers are, as always, kind of a day late on the news.
I was in Sri Hartamas yesterday for lunch and all was quiet on the hood of the palace.
Oh,
no fanfare, nothing, but I guess they were having dinner somewhere else.
Yeah, there's, in fact, it's in the news as well, the dinner that celebrated the installation. Now, just coming back to the lineup that we have this morning, Julian, on the Breakfast Grill, I speak to Professor Barry Eichengreen. He's a professor of economics and political science at the University of California, and we looked at Donald Trump. This interview was done before certain events changed in the last couple of weeks. Things have moved so rapidly, including the confirmation of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch. That hadn't happened when we were discussing it, but we did have a discussion about the American political system. So if you're interested in the inner workings and the dynamics of the American political system, why you know, a president who's a Republican, you know, holding the executive, and with a Congress that also is Republican, still having trouble with his legislative agenda and how that's going to impact markets.
Yeah, I think some breaking news in the past hour or so that Donald Trump is proposing to cut American corporate taxes to about 15%, which is really low, seeing that they have one of the most punitive tax regimes in the capitalistic world. And this is pertinent for your interview because, you know, low taxes, lower involvement of the government over there, which places even more focus on how the government is going to work over there. Because they, I mean, they has all sorts of plans to really jumpstart the economy over there. And with less revenue, the question is how he's going to do that.
Yeah, you know, in fact, the tax cut agenda was predicated in a success on a successful repeal and replace for Obamacare. So they were going to kind of shift resources around. And the failure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, or popularly known as Obamacare, is actually going to bear heavily on the American state. So it would be interesting to get more insight into this tax reform agenda and how the American government is going to pay for it. So that's, remember, that's at the 8 o'clock, Professor Barry Eichengreen. Now, at 8:30, of course, we pick up on some of the news that happened over the weekend. The first round in the French presidential elections, that was on Sunday.
Yep.
And we have the forerunners. So we know that two individuals are now in the race. It was a field of 11, though much of the media focused on the top five contenders in that race. We speak to Pascal Venaison. He's a professor at the Institute of Defense and Strategic Studies in Singapore. So we're going to be speaking to him live at just after the 8:30.
So this is this is apparently the end of a duopoly in the French political system, because over the last 40 years, the socialists as well as the conservative governments have alternated their power sharing, as it were. But today we have in the front runners two completely complete outsiders dominating the votes, you know. And I think all is not okay yet, because almost half of the vote went to the populist right-wing candidates. And then Mr. Macron himself, of course, in the front lead now. I think the markets would breathe a sigh of relief because, you know, he wants to stay in the EU.
Yeah. So, but Macron was a member of François Hollande's cabinet. So he was a member of the Socialist Party. He broke away from that, set up his own movement called Forward, I think it's called. And so he's seen or described as a centrist. Marine Le Pen, of course, is from the National Front, which was really a kind of outlier, you know, a fringe group that's now come to the center of French politics, as you rightly put out. The other two, the center, right in the center, and the center, well, no, actually the center right.
And the far left.
Fillon. Yeah. He got something about 19%, whereas Mélenchon, who's actually a far-left candidate, also got about 19% of the vote.
So yeah, you're talking about hair's breadth, right? All the differences seem very small, and all of them total up equal to over 80 or 90% of the votes that are being counted.
For the top four,
yeah. But I think interesting that Fillon is throwing his support behind Macron, and Jean-Luc Mélenchon has not decided who he wants to support. And I think he has outsourced this decision to his supporters.
Yeah, he said, you know, well, follow your conscience. Now, what's interesting is whether left-wing, far-left supporters will vote for a right-wing party on the because of some commonalities. They're both anti-EU. And, you know, Le Pen is, of course, also promised to make France great again and to, you know, restore dignity to French workers. So, I mean, so that's part of the social agenda that Le Pen seems to have. How she's going to deliver this is quite curious. I mean, some media is referring to her ideas about the economy as a form of a nostalgia for a time that, you know, France will never return to, as they put it. Are they right? Is she right, you know, in this regard? But what's clear is that the traditional parties, as you rightly point out, Julian, have lost their luster. People aren't voting along those party lines anymore. There's a real great disruption in French politics today.
I think there is also going to be a fear factor that's going to play among the minds of the voters. And do you think that everyone will now gang up against Marie Le Pen and give Emmanuel Macron a landslide victory?
Well, you know, that's what the markets, I think, are kind of supposing. That's the assumption they're working on, because the bump in the market, the positive response to the thing is based on the idea that Macron will win. Right, and that all those other votes will go to him. But there are several scenarios. One is that people just don't come out. They didn't vote in the first round for these two candidates, and they're not going to vote in the second round because they're not going to give their votes necessarily to another candidate. Though I think there was a poll that was done over the since the election that suggests that many of Mélenchon's supporters will not vote for Marine Le Pen. So the question was, will you vote for Marine Le Pen in a Macron-Le Pen fight? And it's like the numbers are really tiny for all the other candidates.
Yeah.
Something under the order of 20% voting for Marine Le Pen in the second round. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so maybe, but polls have been wrong. So we go back to the specter of when the polls have got it wrong. They got it wrong apparently over the Trump presidential election. The U.S. presidential election that brought Trump to power. So, well.
Yeah, interesting. Also, I saw in my email market commentary this notion of a peak populism being introduced, i.e., the feeling that we are seeing the end of this wave of populism, and this is going to be good for the market because the market, fearing the aftermath of Brexit and the close call in the Dutch and French elections, now want to go back to some degree of normality, and therefore voting back a semblance of sanity back into the market.
Yeah, so there's this, I guess, a theory about how politics works, and we had a wave of democratization in the 80s, mostly associated with Latin American countries, and there was an expectation that this would happen to Europe, falling on the Trump phenomena, populists would gain, people would be saying, well, it's not so bad, because I think the psychology of it is when an outlier wins, everybody says, you see, they can win and the world doesn't come to an end. So let's take that risk and let's put our vote behind the so-called unpredictable candidate.
I don't really buy into that feeling, though, because I think over the long term, there is still very huge inequality gaps in the world. And this is going to make the populace and all these disenfranchised more and more restive. And I think that the fear going forward is that they'll rise up, especially when you talk about robots taking away our jobs, and you talk about the kind of plutocracy that we're living in right now. So much wealth concentrated in just a few people, and people are a great part of the world is poor, living under $3 a day, extreme poverty. Half of the world is living under $3 a day. And if they're not given the due jobs, and I think this is something that's relevant coming up to May Day, I don't think we're seeing the end of this.
Well, one of the strategies apparently that the Le Pen camp is going for is to look at Macron's background. I mean, he worked for Rothschild, and so basically he's a man of the elite. I mean, he's young, he's 39, he's, depending on your preferences, he's reasonably good looking, he's telegenic, he has this idea that one has to embrace globalization even as one goes forward. One has to embrace pluralism, diversity, even when one is concerned about national security. So he takes a kind of middle-of-the-road approach. We need to do both, as it were, globalization and think about the welfare of French workers in this instance.
But I'd say he'd fit right into a Trump cabinet.
He would?
Yeah.
Oh.
Macron, yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, that's all Trump has hired, right? People from the banking sector, your Goldman Sachs of the world.
Yeah, so the question is whether Macron's cabinet would be similar. Also, very important note, Le Pen and Macron together hold three seats in a parliament of over 500. So when it comes to mid-year June parliamentary elections, how is that going to play out? Will they need the parliament with them in going forward in terms of their own governance agenda if either of them takes power? So a lot of complex issues, and we're going to be talking about that just after the 8:30 news. Also after the 9:30 news, we have the BBC, and BBC also focuses on French politics today. We'll be back with more after this, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, the morning run continues, and I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Julian Ng.
Good morning.
Good morning. And we're going to be looking briefly at, controversies in the sporting world. No less, we have one back home on our shores. The former sprinter, Watson Nyambak, aghast, by the way, television announcer, presenter, pronounced his father's name in a show called Sukanta Central, and clearly making fun of the name. If you haven't watched it, this was an instance where the person turned the name Nyambek made it sound like a sheep. So then Nyambek, he said.
Okay.
That was seen as insulting to the sprinter. The studio.
It is very insulting, actually.
Well, when you turn somebody's name into. But actually, Julian, I don't really know the show, but when I had a quick look at it, Sukanta Central sounds like it was a mashup of sporting stuff, but the style and the. The demeanor of the presenters is kind of comedic, a lot of humor stuff. So they obviously thought this was funny, but it's always easy to be funny about other people's culture and other people's heritage than it is of your own. So,
Well, we come back to the question of whether there are any sacred cows in comedy. And yeah, whether this is one of them.
Yeah, clearly. The issue is whether we should frame this as a question of what's allowable within the world of comedy. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, we had that Singaporean comedian and announcer,
Najib
Ali, who in a kind of show, kind of humorous, kind of current affairs driven show, one of the contestants kind of made fun of the prime minister, or at least they set it up. So the prime minister of Malaysia was kind of, gently mocked.
Yeah, and also we covered Gordon Ramsay dissing pictures of people's cooking from all over the world, and he managed to insult half of India.
Like 90%, I think.
90% of India for some comments on an Indian breakfast.
Yeah, he mentioned the tray and say, do you all live in a prison? Yeah, so should we frame this, all these comments, within those terms?
Talking about sacred cow, Sharad, there was also the Mufti's, Perlis Mufti's cow poem, and that is not comedy, right?
There
has to be some distinction here.
Yeah, so there was a political commentary looking, I think Perlis Mufti, who has in fact apologized unreservedly, and this is of course coming at hot on the heels of dozens of police reports made against him, saying that in fact this was a reflection on what's happening in India, contemporary Indian politics, the cow protection campaign that's actually led to the deaths of people. And so that's a little more serious. Watson Nyambek and this Watson Nyambek himself is taking very seriously. I believe he's already lodged a police report and is looking potentially to sue TV Tiga. So an apology has been issued by PrimeWorks Studio Executive Chief Officer Ahmad Izam Omar on behalf of TV Tiga and TV9.
I mean, going back to the idea of whether these guys had artistic license to make fun of the name, I think in ordinary circumstances, it would be okay, but I take exception to this because I think that part of it really depends on whether the figure that you're making fun of is famous or not. I mean, you don't want to go and diss and make fun of the underdogs who need a little bit of nudge and help to forward their causes or their career, right? And we are also currently living in a situation where there is not enough racial harmony. I mean, if you make fun of a leader who takes the policy of going against racial harmony, I think that's fine. But you know, with I think Watson Nyambeg, he might be a towering figure in sports, but he's still the small guy, and he shouldn't be made fun of.
Yeah, so there is that. There's also, I think, increasing sensitivities in Sarawak over the way in which people in the peninsula either have absolutely no idea about Sarawak, its culture, its own dynamics, its diversity, and you know, there's a whiff of arrogance about peninsula people, according to, I think that's a perspective a lot of people in Sarawak and even Sabah, about the way the
Absolutely.
Peninsula lords,
yeah.
lords itself over, people in the east of Malaysia. So I think maybe all that is coming to kind of converging in this moment in the Watson Nyambeg story. But even, you know, around the world, we see, you know, controversies. And sometimes, you know, Julian, it's really hard to frame this correctly. I don't know sometimes. For instance, we just had the news. It's come on. It's breaking news. Serena Williams, world tennis champion, she said that Ilia Natase, who is a Romanian tennis player of a vintage, she's now about 70 years old, made remarks about her unborn child. So she is pregnant, and her husband is actually the Reddit founder, and he said something to the effect of, you know, will the child be chocolate with milk? Now, oh. Serena Williams, of course, is an African-American. The husband is not, I believe he's white, and... I don't know how you would describe it in American terms, but the comment just kind of descriptive? Was it meant to be nasty? She thinks it's nasty. Not only does she think it nasty, she thinks it's racist.
I think so too. I mean, I think in this day and age, especially with the kind of position that you occupy, I mean, this Nastasi is the Romania's Fed Cup captain, whatever that means, and he should be really circumspect about the kind of comments that he would make. And it's totally inane to say that somebody's baby, to make comments about the color of somebody's baby.
But the baby's not born. I mean, we in Malaysia, we have all kinds of ways to describe people's color. We look at, you know, and we'll say kopi susu, and, you know, people will, and is that racist or is it descriptive? Is it because it may not be negative or pejorative. It's just a question of, of saying, well, the child might, if a child has biracial heritage, then maybe they're going to be, you know, of a different color. I mean,
I think it really depends on the position that you occupy. And I think that for Nastasi, he occupies an official position. And anything that comes out of his mouth, if it goes on to the world press, would be taken with a certain level of official status, right? So he should be really careful about what he says. I mean, if he's saying it, I'm not saying it's okay if it's being uttered privately, you know, but that's different from making a statement as an official person about a certain organization.
Yeah, he's, of course, got into trouble for making rude remarks about women and women tennis players in the past, I think, but he made those remarks from the stand. So he seems to be one of those people who can't, who doesn't have a filter, or, you know, who speaks out of turn, or, you know, likes to court controversy by saying, rude things. Just to kind of to give a bit more background on Serena Williams' husband. His name is Alexis Kerry Ohanian, and he's an Armenian-American. So that's his ethnic background. But again, you know, does it really matter? Why is Natase so focused on the question of the color of the kid or
exactly.
its biracial
heritage? I think what would have been more appropriate if he asked the question of whether the baby would grow up to be another sports star or a technological magnate.
Okay.
Maybe that's a more appropriate question.
Yeah, whose footsteps? But, you know, maybe that's something that your uncles and aunties ask, not somebody who's just sort of, part of that kind of celebrity world where you're kind of fighting for media attention. I mean, and honestly, I mean, you know, I personally, I think, you know, we have cultures where we celebrate diversity, and skin color and the shape of your nose or the shape of your eyes or the you know, the kind of hair you have, whether it's curly or not. It's all part of that. And it's, to say one thing or the other isn't necessarily bad. If you think of, you know, like in the Malay language, we have words or expressions to describe people's color, you know, sawo padi, sawo matang, or which is a kind of like you're kind of golden brown, I believe, or hitam manis. I mean, these are not bad words to describe people. They're just a description of, you know, how people are. Well, we'll be back with more after this. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was Talk To Me by Stevie Nicks. Julian, talk to me. You know, what do you feel? It's now 40 minutes past 6 in the morning.
Is that an invitation?
It's an invitation to talk, yeah, about anything your heart desires, especially the article that you read called Silicon Valley's Executives Are Hiring Philosophers to Teach Them to Question Everything.
You know, we have seen all these new roles coming into the market. For example, a chief technology officer was something that was introduced many years back at the advent of the tech revolution. And then we now see CIMB recently hired a new chief fintech officer, right? Sign of the times. And now apparently Silicon Valley is talking about a chief philosophy officer, because apparently when you philosophize your way of doing business, you can achieve better performance, peak performance. That's what Silicon Valley is all about, right? And Silicon Valley is always tinkering with these cutting-edge thoughts and ways of doing things. For example, polyphasic sleep, right? We'll go into that another time.
That's a polysyllabic word. I mean, it's too early in the morning, I think,
self-improvement, you know, always trying to get beyond what you're capable of.
Yeah. I think the what's interesting about business is that it's in some ways agnostic about all these divisions. You know, the best kinds of entrepreneurs are ones who don't just do what is customary. They're always looking to innovate. That seems to be the you know, the chief value of the kind of worldview that they have. Why would you have philosophy? Philosophy, of course, is the, in some sense, the mother of all knowledge, at least in the Western tradition. I think it's true of the Eastern tradition as well. I mean, it's the foundations, right? And so, you know, teaching somehow you know, we think now philosophy is an arcane subject that's perhaps, you know, that's taught in universities, that sometimes not. I don't think any Malaysian university, by the way, has a department of philosophy, which is quite tragic in itself. But the point is that you know, it's only taught and only some people do it, whereas you think that philosophy should be the foundations of everybody's education. Because it's really about the way in which you learn to learn. It's the way in which you think about thinking.
Mm-hmm. And there is this guy, Andrew Taggart, whom the article calls a gadfly for hire. And he says that this idea of Silicon Valley firms moving into philosophy will only result in misery, because this thought of optimizing one's life and business is actually something that's impossible to achieve. And he says that the question of how can I be more successful is a wrong question. It's far more important to ask why be successful. So, Sirat, you run the night school.
Along with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat,
yes. Is there something wrong about the question that we are asking today? Because it's all premised on how to be successful, how to achieve growth, etc. Are we asking the wrong question? Should we be asking the question of whether we should even have any growth?
Okay, so simply put, why as opposed to how? The hows are always kind of the mechanics to get from point A to point B, having already defined what your objectives are. The why, in some sense, is a pause. You're saying, before we get to the hows, let's ask ourselves, what is the end, you know, that we want to achieve, and the deeper meaning of that. But at the end of the day, I think that, you know, when you start talking about the whys, which is an endless conversation, it's a conversation that perhaps has no end, it does feed into the hows. So having that conversation itself is a valuable exercise. It, rather than, you know, thinking of the asking of the why as kind of a, think of a board meeting where everybody gets together and say, well, you know, over coffee, we're going to decide on the real meaning of success. And when, in 2 hours, we're going to we're going to have an answer. And then we're going to proceed by kind of operationalizing that. I do think that the point about philosophy, and if you, you know, if you study any philosophy, you look back at the Greeks, they're asking the same, we are still asking many of the same questions that were being asked, you know, 2,000 years ago. And that's because it's the nature of the question. How that's going to impact companies, I don't know. And I'm not quite sure why, except that perhaps there's this real premium place on thinking differently. And philosophy is precisely that tool for you to interrogate just about everything, because it's all about the very stuff of your thinking, you know, the concepts you use, the presumptions you made, the logic of your argumentation or the lack of it, as it may be. So I can see absolute reason for introducing it into a company situation.
For me, I think it really answers the question of whether we should survive in a very competitive world or we should be happy. And I think those two questions are very contradictory. And rightly or wrongly, I get a lot of my ideas from pop culture. So I've been watching Billion, this new show about a hedge fund company. And this might be right up a lot of people's alley because it's about markets, it's about the glamour and the allure of a hedge fund and fund management position. But something that is novel within the structure of the protagonist company is a psychologist within the company to spur people on into peak performance. And this doesn't necessarily make the staff happy. It just makes them perform better, you know. So I don't know if we are at odds when we come to work and we ask for job satisfaction and we ask for work-life balance. You know, that's something that's quite impossible.
Yeah,
to
achieve. The question is also what we mean by happiness. You know, people think happiness is a smile on your face, a step in your walk, and you know, the thing that you might get from taking a lot of sugar. I mean, is, you know, whereas happiness could be actually deeper meaning and meaning. Meaningfulness in the things that
and
you already
do. And surely you can't find that in your cubicle in the office, can you?
Well, you might. I mean, who knows? You're right. But I do think that, okay, so we're talking about the office, but I certainly think philosophy should be there in the schools for everybody. And we're going to be tweeting out the link to that story about philosophy being introduced in sort of corporations. But I'm also going to add to that one that's about kids and in a project that's quite old now about reintroducing philosophy for young people in schools and why this is very important and to do it at a kind of foundational level. But coming back to your question of the company, Julian, I think when people think of philosophy, they think, oh my God, there'll be paralysis. Basically, once you ask deeper questions, you're not going to be able to do anything. And the idea of the philosopher being a sort of indolent figure, you know, reclining, drinking or smoking or whatever it is.
Not quite, right?
Thinking deeply about the world and never actually doing anything about it.
Yeah. It invariably falls down to stoicism. A lot of these ideas that are being bandied about in the Silicon Valley invariably boils down to that. Stoicism apparently is the thing to follow. But also, you're very right in saying that there is a misconception about philosophers because right now the practice is more skewed towards psychology and psychiatry in terms of what people accept in America, and not really philosophy, which boils down to almost the same thing because this talk therapy, right? Talking about the meaning of life, and that happens in both those disciplines.
What do you think? You know, you worked in a bank, Julian. You worked in the kind of corporations. What do you think would really free up people to think in imaginative ways about the way they do things? Or is there a real premium on just following processes? You know, we have that whole debacle about the United Airlines, and Jeff Bezos from Amazon said the problem here was process over people. But beyond that, I mean, how is it that corporations or any entrepreneur can think in imaginative ways about things.
I feel that, personally, I think there should be a complete paradigm shift, because I'm a fine example of someone who wasn't happy at my job, in my previous job in the banking sector. I mean, I woke up every day dreading that work day. And I think to extrapolate this, if I may, to something that's far bigger and addressing the question of why are we here, right? What's the meaning of this all? I think it boils down to corporations just trying to achieve growth, peak growth, and trying to squeeze out a few percentage points of growth. And that's an unsustainable idea, even from the viewpoint of economists. Like, if you've read Thomas Piketty, right? He's saying that the current growth rates of the world is an aberration, because if you look at the long term, the world grows just ever so gingerly. And, you know, for us to try to bang into our heads and into our employees that we got to achieve 20, 30, 40% growth every year, it just results in a lot of misery.
Yeah, misery seems to be something that's spreading globally, and maybe maybe philosophy can assuage us. Alan de Botton, you know, The Constellations of Philosophy, a book that you might want to pick up, or even the documentary on which there's a documentary based on that, which really is very interesting. It's a popular philosophy, something that I'm going to tweet that out too. Alan de Botton's The Constellations of Philosophy might help you get through the day. Who knows? EFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.